Welcome to Season 6, Episode 2 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we review and discuss sandbox adventures that are currently available. And we also take a little look at the influences of MMOs on the hobby. Again, welcome to Season 6, Episode 2 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this week is Jay.
And, hello.
Yeah, and strangely enough, we were supposed to have kind of a guest host, but I don't know, call it technical difficulties on our end, the phase of the moon. The stars were just not aligned for some odd reason today.
Well, the things were, the deck was stacked against him right from the start.
You think so?
Well, with his last name, like Stack, yeah, why not?
I wasn't going to use his name, but okay, you beat me to it.
Oh, yeah, I guess, well, you know, privacy issues, whatnot, maybe.
Who knows? But we didn't use his first name this time, so hopefully we won't worry about that. But hey, you know what? We're gonna trudge on and see what we can do. But yeah, it was just it was not easy getting this episode started. Technical difficulties on my end, on a couple of different ways, and I even had network issues earlier today that I had to sort out. So it's kind of amazing that we're even recording at the end of the day.
Well, we normally record at the end of the day anyways, but yeah, I know what you mean.
You know what I mean. So, well, why don't we hit the few news items that we actually have this week, which are, you know, then I think there's two big ones.
Let's do it.
The first big one, of course, is D&D is 40 years old, supposedly.
Happy 40th to you.
Of course, wasn't it supposed to, the 40th supposed to be something like, I forget the actual date, like January, like 8th or 9th or something like that?
Well, that's just it. They don't, my understanding is they don't really know the actual date. And so their historian, kind of a D&D historian, which there really is such a thing, believe it or not. He pegged the fourth Sunday because apparently Sunday was the day that Gary had invited kind of the world, so to say. He'd opened up his doors to the public, say, come see what Dungeons & Dragons is about. And it was the fourth Sunday, so we chose the fourth Sunday, which just happened to be the 26th. And so, you know, it's about as official as anything can be, given what we don't know about it. So,
okay, well, there you go. That's what we don't know is what we don't know. But, yeah, it's 40 years old, give or take. Of course, you know, it's kind of like anything else. You know, any holiday you want to invent, it's not ever accurate. Thank you very much. Just one of those things. But it is 40 years old, which is kind of it's kind of weird because, you know, I'm a little over 40 myself.
Same
and,
here.
You know, it's kind of a strange thing when you sit down and think about it, that that the game's been out almost as long as we've been alive. You know, I mean, for us, I mean, you know, it's like I was like 3 or so when it was created, give or take, 2, 3.
Yeah, it was 5 or 6, something like that.
You know, and it's kind of
just a couple of grognards.
Yeah, well, yeah, I sort of am. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I mean, I game probably, I don't know if you want to call it the gold or silver age of gaming, because we might get into that in my discussion with MMOs, but, you know, it was definitely a different time.
From our perspective, it's probably the Stone Age.
The Stone Age? Maybe. But, you know, all games begin somewhere, so they all begin in the Stone Age anyway. But, yeah, so 40 years, which is cool. And, of course, hey, you know what? How else to celebrate 40 years than to, of course, have the announcement that the that WotC has for the new storyline for D&D, which is the Tyranny of Dragons? Is that right?
Yeah.
Tyranny.
Tyranny of Dragons.
It's one of those things where I look on the front of the page, and I want to say it differently than what I know it's pronounced as. Does that sound messed up? And so I guess, you know, the big push is to have dragons and, of course, gaming and Tiamat. In particular, I got the impression was important this go around.
Yeah, you know, it's well, the interesting thing about that is you know, like you said, Tiamat is the big villain throughout this particular series, and the press release said something about that Tiamat had never been used in an official product, which I thought was strange because the Scales of War adventure path that came out when fourth edition was first released, the main villain was, minor spoilers here, if you haven't guessed already, Tiamat. And so it was interesting that they had mentioned that, of course, and in the Dungeons & Dragons cartoons, if you watch those at all, Tiamat was more often than not the primary villain of any given episode. So,
yeah, which is just kind of strange.
So. Yeah, but, you know, Tiamat's she's an old staple and definitely a worthy opponent for any series. So whether or not she's been used before or not, that's fine. So it was John Peterson, apparently, who was the name of the historian/author. He wrote a book called Playing at the World, which was a history about Dungeons and Dragons. He's the one who arbitrarily chose Sunday, January 26th, based on his chronology that he was able to find. And so there you go. That's where that date came from.
All right. So there's that's kind of an interesting little thing. Of course, also Gen Con 2014. Badges are now available for purchase, and my understanding, the housing block is open, although someone I know that tried to get into the housing block today, what can I say? Apparently, the servers crashed several times.
Yeah, well, and from what I understand, I saw some tweets about it already being full, or at least mostly full, so at least the downtown stuff.
Yeah, well, that's always, it's always rough, because I don't know. It's, yeah, my understanding is that they actually arranged for shuttles from all the various places to increase, you know, the amount of hotels that are available.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So, I mean, it's like they're going to have a shuttle from the airport to downtown, I think, as well, is what my understanding is. During certain times, it's going to be like a $10 from the airport to downtown.
Yeah, I took that last year, actually.
Oh, was that? You know, because it's funny because I think the bus that I took a couple of years ago, the guy was saying that they weren't going to do that anymore. And I'm guessing that company just lost the contract.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, actually, I used that shuttle. It was great. Got me to and from the airport just fine to my hotel. And yeah, it was pretty flawless. Actually, the funny thing was, on our way, we were standing at the bus stop, and we had a number of taxis come by and basically offer to take us to the airport for the same price. But I figured, you know, I'll stick with the shuttle because, you know, sometimes they may not honor their word.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of that's kind of the interesting thing there. And then let's see what else we've got. We got just basically there was this quick article about Games Workshop and the fact that they announced that their revenues was 10.4% down, I guess, last quarter last year, which is kind of interesting. And of course, you know, I guess they have they're a traded company apparently, and their shares dropped like almost 24% or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, are they in trouble? And I'm like, they're a small game company. They might be in trouble. They might not. You know, that's the way.
They're always in trouble.
No, I mean, let's face. I mean, I really, you know, even some of the people that you think are big are not that big. Strangely enough.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know. Now, and in their case, they have a double. They have a real problem with the fact that, let's say, you know, they do a lot of Warhammer. They do a lot of miniatures. The miniature world is definitely changing, and you know. Take the Kickstarter we had, you know, that we talked about last time, which was that 3D customizable printable one.
Yeah, right.
They met their goal already. I still think they got like 20 something days left or something ridiculous like that. They're at $198,000 when I checked it earlier today.
Sweet.
They've unlocked 4 add-ons for that. Additional races, mounted characters, sci-fi miniatures, spell effects. And they still got like 3 or 4, you know, like if they get up to 300,000, I think they're going to have like modern day characters available.
Very cool.
So it's like, wow, that's, I mean, don't get me wrong. The buy-in price to even get like one of their first run minis is
like $20, isn't it?
$20, $30, $40, something like that. And you're not going to see the product until sometime like end of this year. However, I said it last time and I'll say it again. I think this is kind of the future of what we're going to see. Maybe not, you know, if not, maybe not just custom ordering, but eventually 3D minis from the standpoint of, hey, you know, we have our own 3D printer. Let's print our own minis. I think that's very doable. And I don't think, you know, I think we would be remiss in thinking otherwise.
Yeah. On a side note, actually, today announced was a carbon fiber 3D printer.
Well, there you go. And that's actually pretty cool. I mean,
yeah.
Carbon fiber is a pretty interesting thing if you really sit down and think about it. So, no.
Yeah, I don't know if it's detailed enough with the resolutions to do 3D miniatures, but it's like $5,000, which is, you know, not pocket change, but you know,
but I'm just saying, you know, 10 years from now, I mean, I think we're going to be 3D printing a lot of things.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, we remember when big flat screen TVs came out, right? They were like $8,000, you know. And here it is, 10 years later. You walk into Costco, you could walk out with a 55-inch for $800, you know. So yeah, I agree. 3D printing is, 10 years from now, we'll be 3D printing all kinds of crap.
So that's kind of cool. So there you go. We actually only got two Kickstarters that I actually kind of want to mention in the news, besides obviously the 3D printable ones. First one up is Time Watch, which is based off of Gumshoe. It's an investigative time traveling RPG, and it's $25 for the PDF and like $40 for a print version. And I've always heard good things about the Gumshoe system. I don't know if you ever have.
Oh yeah, I reviewed Loremaster, which was a Gumshoe adaptation for Pathfinder. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm always hesitant to do time travel in any way, time travel or peril the dimensions, which apparently this system both covers. But, you know, I could see where if you were going to do some sort of adventure like that, most of them tend to be based on some sort of investigative thing. So I could see where this could be a good fit. You know?
Yeah, definitely.
So, very interesting. So, there you go. If you're looking for a time travel game, and you don't want to do Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's funny. You know, Doctor Who it involves time travel only kind of, sort of, if you've ever watched both the old and new shows.
Well, yeah, because it's a tiny, whiny, wobbly, something, whatever, how they say it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just, where can we have an adventure today? Okay, there we go. You know, which is fine, you know. I mean, in many ways, I mean, Star Trek did the same thing, you know. Like, they travel from planet to planet. Every planet's a little different. There you go. What does this planet have? Oh, we have people with giant triangle hats or something. Reminds me, I actually saw a comparison one time where they showed all the funky outfits that Star Trek The Next Generation had for costumes and, of course, you know, the original series as well. Very bizarre stuff, to say the least. Anyway, and last up is the Kickstarter for Earth Dawn 4th Edition. I never really played Earth Dawn. Did you ever play Earth Dawn?
I don't believe I did. No, I don't.
No,
I don't.
No. You know, it's an old FASA product. I think, I don't know who, you know what, I actually have to check. I don't actually remember who's doing the current one. Is it still technically FASA? That doesn't make sense. I don't know why it doesn't make sense.
Is it Catalyst?
It claims it's FASA Games, but that doesn't make sense because I didn't know FASA existed like that anymore. Of course, someone could have obviously bought the name, but the Kickstarter says FASA.
Interesting.
Now, that said, do you know what's interesting about FASA?
Well, there's lots of interesting things about FASA. Was it Jordan? What's his name? Who started it?
I don't know. Do you know who? That I don't know, but do you know how they started their business?
I do not.
They started off as a traveler licensee.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I remember you mentioned that in your segment on traveler.
Yeah. Because it stands for, like, I want to say, like, Fredonia or something, some strange place with an F. Air and Space Administration.
Ah, nice.
So, there you go. There's your news. How's that for consistently? I think this is the shortest news segment we've done in a while.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm going to make it just a tad bit longer, if that's okay.
Yeah, we can. We got a couple of minutes.
We were talking about last week, or last show, I should say, we talked about Storyscape, which was a all-digital RPG product meant to be played. It's more than a virtual tabletop. It has its own rule system that's more complex and takes advantage of the computer, et cetera, et cetera. Anyways, long story short, my segment last show also happened to be about the ability to use skills and attributes in a more versatile way than just using them as marked in the rule books for Dungeons and Dragons. And so I was there. They sent out one of their Kickstarter updates, and this was a perfect example of what I was talking about. The way their system is going to work is exactly the way I was talking about it, though I think they explain it better than I did. And just these short three paragraphs. So, for example, let's say your character has the parachute skill and you've bailed out of a sky car and you're plummeting through a refinery complex and it's crucial that you avoid the plasma vents. You must use agility plus parachute. Or you're investigating a possible homicide and you want to know if the victim's parachute was packed correctly. You might use reasoning plus parachute. Or you're Indiana Jones and the pilot has just bailed out with the last parachute, leaving you with nothing more than a crate of chickens, a kid, a showgirl, and an emergency raft. You might use creativity plus parachute. And this is exactly what I was talking about. So yeah, I read this and I was like, that is exactly what I would like to adapt my skills and attributes in my D&D Next game to do, something exactly like this. So
yeah, it's interesting. Is there any other RPG that does things like that, or am I high?
Well, the success system also does something like this as well.
I was about to say, because it didn't sound revolutionary. It sounds like I've heard that before, but it makes a lot of sense. So
yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I think doesn't Shadowrun do something like that too? Or
I don't know. I really forget. I've had all my experiences with Shadowrun have been bad.
Ooh. Well, we don't want to stir up bad memories, so.
Oh, I think they're more bad for my ex-wife than me, so, hey. what can I say? We had a interesting character running the game, and I think he was more interested as a game master in seeing his NPCs shine than the players.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've even done a segment on that before, too.
Oh, yeah. What can we say? We've done quite a few, so. All righty. Okay, well, we have actually had a little bit of good luck. The guest host actually showed up, so we're gonna. And his topic, in case those that were not interested, was open world gaming. We did, So unfortunately, that was not in the intro bumper. But hey, you get for those of you that listen well, guess what? You get an extra special prize. You get a third topic on this episode instead of the
gold star.
Yes, instead of the original ones that you were promised. So, Ben, welcome to the show, and thank you for, obviously working through our technical issues and whatever technical issues you have, real or imagined.
Roger that.
So, exactly what are you meaning by open world gaming in the first place?
Well, I should give it a qualifier. The gaming group that I play with I've been playing with these. I'm 42 years old, and I've been playing with these guys since I was 14, 15 years old.
You're in good company, at least with us. We're about that age, so.
Excellent. So I've known these guys, most of my life, and
my condolences.
I feel your pain. So we live all over the country. We're rarely together anymore, but we all went to high school together, and we have a combination of what I would call power gamers and rules lawyers.
That sounds about right for that era. Yeah.
Which makes virtually anything planned difficult. So what we have fallen into is doing what we call basically open gaming, in that we have a setting and a rule set that we agreed to. So lately, last several years in a way, we've been playing Pathfinder, but prior to that, we played AD&D 3.5, and we've played a lot of Top Secret, Special Investigation. I don't know if you guys know that game, but it's
Top Secret
way
SI.
Back.
That was one of those weird games that all the supplements for that game really sucked.
Yeah. But the core rules were easy.
The core rules were easy, and the intro adventure was probably one of the best intro adventures I'd ever seen. in terms of like a spy setting, you know, because the assumption was is that none of the player characters were actually spies, and they just, it was almost kind of like that. What the hell was that TV series?
Mrs. King and Scarecrow.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where it's like accidental are like that man with one red shoe kind of scenario. You know, accidental spies and thing happen. You know, but yeah, the game system was really easy. So yeah, I've owned that set. I have no idea what I ever did with it, but all the supplements were just honestly plain sucked.
Yeah, yeah. Towards the end, they would sell books just full of guns and stats and, you know,
and they had
some fancy label on it, like Commando Edition, but it was just 1,000 more guns that are all basically the same.
Yeah, because the stats there wasn't a lot of variation, really, that you could really do.
Commando Edition, not wearing any underwear.
Yeah, pretty much. That, and they had a really strange, like, almost like low-powered supers kind of thing.
Yeah.
I forget what the hell that was, but it was like, okay, are you trying to be a superhero game or a spy game? I don't get how it can be both.
I think they were trying to make sales. They were trying to expand their horizon. But what I really liked about that, I don't know how we got on this, but that system was like no other in that it had this weird thing where you had no hit. Well, you had hit points, but they were specific to parts of your body. So that as you took damage, I don't know, to say your arm or your leg, then it would become less functional.
Okay, yeah. I it's been a long time since I played it, but yeah. I kind of remember what you're talking about. I mean, there have been other games with kind of quasi-hit locations.
RuneQuest, that was no was quasi.
I was about to say, RuneQuest was one. But that's also because they had the whole partial armor system that was probably one of the better implementations I've seen. Sorry, we digress again. As a listener of this show, you obviously realize that we do that quite a bit.
Oh yes, I do. So. It's part of the fun, is the banter. So open gaming. So because of our party's been together. Well, our group has been together for a long, long, long time, and we are very familiar with everyone's. How can I say this politely? Defects.
I would have gone with quirks, but okay.
Well, no, I'm going to be stronger. I'm going to say defects. So
I'm defective. Okay.
What happened is if someone, you know, being a game master is a huge time investment. You know, you prepare maps or even if you buy a module, you got to read everything. I mean, it's a lot of work. And
No, you put all the players in a box and you kill them in 10 seconds and you go home.
Well,
no, go ahead.
And then you drink beer and eat pretzels and watch football. But what we found was, well, what our group has found over the years is that in order for us all to get along and for us all to achieve what we want to achieve, the overarching story arc that the game master might have planned, never seems to work, and that the players, I mean, I'm making this up, but let's say you had to go to Castle Wolfenstein and kill the dragon, the players would be distracted by something shiny off to the west and would never get there. And so the story arc would just never go that way. So basically what open gaming is where you have a genre, a movie or a book or a series of books works really well, because it gives the players a common context. But basically, as the game master, you don't have to do a lot of prep. You know, we're all software people, so you know we can write programs that create NPCs. So that really isn't a big deal. But what it allows you to do is you have a setting that you don't have to describe in very much detail because the players are familiar with it either from books or from movies, and then you put them in a situation, you put them together in circumstance that. Normally, you would, you know, not like, you know, you meet at the pub and you know, be men of adventure. You know, it's not quite like that bad, but something along those lines where you give them some common goal in the beginning and then you just see where it goes. And it's extremely organic. And we even rotate who is the game master from time to time. So the game master in that context kind of is more of a less of a storyteller and more of a facilitator, if that makes sense.
Sure, that makes sense to me.
You know, so they're defining the environment and the cause, or not the cause, but the effect of what the players do, and we've had many total party kills. I won't lie, that's happened more than once, all because the party is dumb. But myself included, I caught.
I'm sorry.
Your players are going to show up for the next game. I'm not playing with you, Ben. You insulted me.
Oh, well, it's all good fun.
I don't know why. I don't know why, but when you said, I was just thinking of, God, I forget this. It was really this really stupid movie in this line. It was like some sort of weird comedy, and there were these. I just remember this one line. It's like, we're stupid, but we are brave. Yeah, that describes most parties I know. So
we have some guys in our party that are current military, and we have some that are former, or a group that is former military, and some they really like tactics, and they will spend
too much time.
Way too much time planning, right? And then as soon as you get the, well, it's like anything else. It never survives first contact, right? Whatever the plan is, it always gets diverged from. And
I don't know who said that. I know that's a military saying.
Yeah, I don't either. I'm probably somebody from Civil War or World War II.
Yeah.
But all I mean is that it is not an easy thing to do because you do have to do some prep. You have to have some NPCs. You have to have some maps. You have to have somewhere to start. But then once you start, and it can be, you know, we sometimes even we'll start with like a quest type thing. But I honestly can't think of a single time we ever finished one. We always went off and did something else. But the frustration level for the game master is a lot less because the party basically does whatever they want to do, and the game master just is responsible for keeping the invention going. And it works really well for us. So that's what I mean by open gaming. So you don't have a prepared module. You don't have a prepared script. You just have some major characters and some common setting that everyone's familiar with. It would be really hard to do with a brand new setting. I know for our group it wouldn't work, but that's basically the concept.
You know, that kind of reminds me of actually, there have been a bunch of new systems that have come out in the last, 5 years that are geared around very much that style of play. That is, you start with next to nothing. You have your characters. These are usually rules light systems. You've probably heard us talk about them on the show before. Mm-hmm. One of my personal favorites is Dungeon World.
Mm-hmm.
That grows, as Jeff likes to say, organically from the seeds of the adventure. You know, another one that we've been playing lately is the Fate Accelerated. Very, very simple characters, and you start, and pretty much we just went and did a open world adventure. As the characters put together their relationships, those allowed adventure seeds. I was the GM, so I just wrote down a bunch of seeds and kind of we went with where the characters wanted to go, you know, as we throw out a clue or something. And half the time when we threw out a clue, I really didn't know what it meant, but, you know, they would invent their own reasonings and we'd say, hey, that sounds good. And so we just ran with it. And,
you know, that's always the best when you're game master. You just put something out there and it's like they come up with like 10,000 reasons of why something should be that way. And you're like, oh, my God, I write this shit down.
Yeah, that's better than what I had planned.
Exactly. Yeah, really. And so, yeah, the open world gaming, you know, it's funny that you mentioned Pathfinder because that's a very rules heavy system. Does the complication or does the complexity, that's the word I'm looking for, does the complexity of the rules alter or affect the open world gaming style that you can perform?
Yes, because we have rules lawyers. So it is difficult to be in combat, spontaneous with a monster or some demigod or some, you know, non-normal corporeal thing.
Oh, yeah, I beat one of those last Thursday.
Right, because these wonderful friends
before breakfast, you know. So.
Right, they will say, oh, but you know they can't do that on the second Tuesdays, and today is Tuesday, or you know some dumbass thing like that. And so, yes, the rules complexity detracts from that. But so long as you stick to your. You know, so like one of our standbys is, and I know this will sound silly, but how often does this happen to you? You're in high level characters. For us, we rarely go higher than say 8. So for me, like 6 is kind of high level, because we either get bored or there's a TPK at that point. But
I'm actually with you. I mean, I know some people that are like, I want to have the 14th level characters. Like, you know, honestly,
what would you do?
I don't know.
I mean, you're basically really invincible.
You know, it's interesting though that if you look at the Pathfinder Adventures paths. Mm-hmm. I think the last, because usually 6 books, and usually the 6th book, you're supposed to like be between 10th and 14th by the. It's like by the end of that 6th book, you're supposed to be about 14th, 15th level, something like that. Actually, wow. Yeah, it's usually that. It's just insane. You're just like, really, okay, but you know, it's just kind of, that's the way the adventure paths for Pathfinder are designed. They're designed to do. We have these 6 books. They're supposed to take you from first level to about 14th, 15th level. So in a series of adventures, and it's, I'm amazed that it makes any type of coherent sense.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
So,
well, my original point was that whenever we get bored, and I wouldn't say bored, but whenever you get a loss for words, there's always the band of goblins, you know. So you get 100 goblins come over the hill. Well, at 6th level, that's still a challenge, you know. And you know, I mean,
death,
I know that
by
sounds
1,000 paper cuts.
I mean, I know that sounds dumb, but if depending on the terrain, you've got to be tactically smart. But I mean, if you get 5 guys around you, you're done. That's it. And the magic types never do real well in that particular situation. But as long as they stay in the center, it's okay. But a lot of it too, as I've noticed, is because of Pathfinder is a medieval type setting. It's not too hard to find plenty of free source material for that stuff. So if you need a town or a castle or a keep or something like that, you know, you can kind of pull that out of your butt in short order.
You know, rinse it off first.
Interestingly enough, I actually find that that's also true for some of the modern stuff too. In a way, you know, because it's modern. So it's like, how many locations can you steal? It's like, they're all, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there. So it's like, it's always like the weird settings, like, okay, well, this is an Old West setting. There's not a lot of diagrams for a lot of Old West stuff. Basically, everything you know about the Old West was this really bad John Wayne movie. I'm not dismissing John Wayne. I actually like a lot of old John Wayne movies, you know. So, you know, there's several. Actually, Big Jake was one of my personal favorites because I kind of like the whole, it's the West, but it's the changing West right before the, you know, the modern era, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of. So, but yeah, you know, I mean, there is a lot of stuff out there. I mean, that's the thing, you know, you're right. With some sort of open setting, you want to have a lot of source material. And, you know, I'm sure we'll get into that with the, Jay's topic too, because there is, depending on what's going on, there is actually quite a bit of material out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any closing thoughts before we get on to Jay's topic?
I think you should try it. I mean, you can have one-off session with your gaming group and give it a shot. I mean, we found for the administrators or game masters, it's less frustrating and more entertaining with less prep work.
The administrators, you're not a computer person, are you?
I'm a software developer.
A software developer. What are we going to do?
Suffer.
40-year-old software developer sitting around talking about Dungeons & Dragons. Who'd have thunk?
Yeah, there's
there's no stereotypes here.
No,
not whatsoever.
You know, well, at least I've been married, and you know, obviously that means something else too. So, you know, because we're not gonna get away from that stereotype.
No, I bathe every day.
That's not what I meant, but you got the idea.
I did.
You know, I'm not Steve Carell. Okay, so next up we actually have what do we want to jump to? You wanted to kind of talk about the sandbox adventures that are available.
Well, yeah, you know, kind of as we mentioned before, dovetailing off of Ben's topic in the open gaming world and the ability to you know, have a wider range of venues through which to explore to appeal to the various player types within your group is something that the sandbox world is great for. But like like Ben also said, that it can take a lot of prep work for the GM. There's maps, there's there's seeds and things like that have to be planted. And so, of course, there have been a number throughout the years, a number of adventures that have sort of provided a framework. Whereas, you know, most adventures, if you buy a module off of the shelf at a particular game store or something, usually what you find is that it's a series of encounters, maybe not quite as railroaded, but, you know, they're definitely designed to be visited in a particular order, whereupon which you usually close out the adventure with a big boss fight of some sort. In fact, Jeff, you mentioned the Paizo adventure paths, six. You subscribe to them, you get six booklets that have, you know, a series of adventures that are meant to be encountered in a particular order, you know, over which you gain a certain amount of experience. And they've planned these encounters based on your pace throughout their adventure path. But there have been some game aids which sort of alleviate some of the work of that Ben was talking about. They provide usually a location, a large location, lots of adventure seeds, and there's usually some sort of central plot that you should at least pay attention to, but they're not exactly designed to be accomplished all at once. You can definitely take side paths and things like that. Mm-hmm. So there were three in particular that I have really enjoyed in my gaming career, and I'm going to talk about one in particular just in the interest of time because I don't know if I'd say it's my favorite, but I think it definitely has some very unique properties that make it very amenable to an open box gaming. Now, the first one I'm mentioning, it's not the one I'm going to talk about a lot, but is, and I'm not sure how to say this, it's Tolis or Patolis. I think it's just Tolis by Monty Cook. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's like an 800-page book.
Already too big for me.
Yeah, well, it's huge. I mean, you want to talk open gaming. I mean, this thing is, I mean, it's not a sandbox. It's a beach. You know, it is huge. And there are all kinds of threads. It's an amazing production. It's currently, to my knowledge, only available in PDF on RPG Now, right? Okay. Though you can find used copies of it, half-price books and things like that. What were you going
to
say, Jeff?
Oh, no, I was about to say, you know, that doesn't surprise me that it's on RPG Now.
Yeah, and but even the PDF like runs like $60. Though if you watch for it, I got it on sale for like $20 during some sale. But I mean, it's not just this book. There's lots of maps that come with it and everything. It's a beautiful product. Of course, Tolis is the campaign that as they were designing Dungeons & Dragons 3rd Edition, this is the campaign they sort of play tested. Of course, the second is the classic that maybe the first adventure most of us played as far as sandbox adventures goes is Keep on the Borderlands.
I was about to say B2 is probably the granddaddy of them all.
Yep. And it's in many ways a very well done adventure as far as sandbox goes. Lots and lots to explore. Of course, there's the Caves of Chaos, which are the central aspect, but you've got the Hermit, you've got the various other aspects that you can go.
Well, there's the swamp and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So those are definitely two ones. A couple of honorable mentions is The World's Largest Dungeon. That's a pretty sandboxy one. Again, another 800-page book. It's not as sandboxy as some of the others. And one of my favorites is The Dragon Delve. That also was by Monty Cook. It was the dungeonaday.com website. That was the name of the adventure, is The Dragon Delve. But the one that I really want to highlight is, ironically, a Pathfinder adventure path called the Kingmaker series. Have you either of you played that at all or
not
read
that,
through it at all?
No, not that one. I have two of them. I have one for where they reintroduce the drow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And yes, people, it is drow. Don't if you come at me and say it could be drow, you can go away.
What is the original source of that term? Is it Tolkien?
No, I have no idea where that comes from, to be honest with you. I just know that I remember reading somewhere that, you know, there was this argument, well, should it be drow or drow? And finally someone was like, it's drow, schmucks. I don't know where you get this drow stuff. Because I even forget where that was officially talked about, and I'm just like, really? Why should we have this conversation? If people want to put out a drow, let them sound like idiots. I don't care. Let them drink whatever whatever they're drinking, let continue, whatever they're smoking. And the other one was, it was the one in the, it was like some weird desert thing where eventually you end up at the City of Brass.
Oh,
it was the one. It was the one right after that. I forget what the I'd have to go in the other room and check, and it's not worth my effort at this point. But you know, again, you know, you're right. Sort of semi sandboxy, but no, those are the adventure paths I have. I've never heard the Kingmaker series.
Well, it is the epitome of sandbox. It was designed to be very sandboxy, and it has some very unique properties which make it not. It's more than just a wide open wilderness that has lots of encounters in it. With a light central arc, it actually has, as its name implies, the PCs are able to become administrators of a kingdom.
Oh, cool!
And so that's why it's called the Kingmaker, and it's a really, really great series. In fact, if I were in your situation, Ben, I would probably crack this thing open and say, okay, here you go. It starts off, it's really wide open. You basically, there's a small kingdom that is feeling threatened by a growing menace from the forest in the south. So they hire some adventurers to go down there and check it out. Of course, the adventurers go, they find out the sinister plot. And after having cleared out this threat, they're left with this wide open wilderness. And so the rulers of this small kingdom decide, hey, you know what, we need to secure this border because right now it's wide open. We don't want this to happen again. And so they basically kind of give a grant to the PCs saying, look, you know, it's wide open wilderness. Why don't you go take care of it? And so the PCs now find themselves with a bunch of land. And so, of course, they want to do something with it. So it gives them opportunities to almost play like a game of civilization, if you will. You can kind of basically become the rulers and stewards of this land. Granted, I guess you're somewhat beholden to the other kingdom, but you know it's really kind of neat. One of the best things about it is because it's so wide open and sandboxy, it allows different characters to shine. So you know you can have your tacticians during the encounters, but you know if you've got people who your social butterflies. And skill monkeys and things like that who want to negotiate and things like that. There's lots of opportunities there.
You know, you know what though? This is actually an interesting thing because when I've played D&D early on, we're talking original first edition,
right?
Or even like the original, the basic expert set. You know, because I never had anything past the expert set.
What was it called? Beckney? Beginners, expert, basic expert, something, masters, and immortals.
How can it be basic and expert at the same time?
No.
Well, it's the series of things.
Okay.
So you play with the basic set. That got you through level 3 or 5. Expert got you through like level 10.
I thought it was like 14 or something. It was
maybe.
Really
could have been. Could have been.
Yeah, and there was like, I forget. It was like, forget what the C was. And there was the master set, and then there was the immortal set. Yeah, I never got past expert because honestly, after, again, like I said, 10th, 14th level, you're just kind of like bored with it. But my point was is that, you know, even in that set and first edition AD&D, I think there was an assumption that once you reach kind of a certain level.
Yeah, usually about level 10.
Well, even before that, you know, 8th, 9th, 7th, things started going a little less like, oh, we have like the monster encounters all the time, to more of a lot of almost what I want to call geopolitical. You know, because by ninth level, a lot of the characters are like, oh, you can build a tower, you can build a castle, you can get followers.
Well, yeah, exactly. How many henchmen do you attract? How many followers do you attract? There were tables for that inside the first edition,
right?
Inside the first edition Dungeon Master Guide.
Exactly. So, I mean, this adventure sounds like they were thinking, you know, we like that old stuff. Let's see if we can create an adventure that does that kind of thing.
And that's, you know, it's funny you mention that because that is exactly what they do. So they actually provide two custom rule sets for the Pathfinder system. One is, of course, a kingdom building thing where I talked a little bit about. That is by far the most interesting part of the modules. Basically, you start with your kingdom, and the kingdom has 6 base statistics, almost like a character. Things like stability, loyalty, economy, things like that. And what happens is you make checks with those based on what you do. So you can do things like you can expand your territory by one hex, and that'll do certain things. It'll give you so many resources, but it may increase your it may decrease your stability. You can build roads, you can build farms, you can build cities. And like I said, I mean, really, if you listen to it, it almost sounds like a game of like Settlers of Catan or something like that. But using this system, you can treat the kingdom that you're building as a character that a whole group is building. And so, and of course, you can set up things within that, like, well, you know, we want to be open up trade negotiations with, you know, the neighboring kingdom. So that gives your opportunity, your character who is, you know, a social butterfly, to the opportunity to shine and things like that.
Right,
so
it's
very unique in that system, or very unique in that measure. Allows you to do, I mean, you can go to war, you can have tournaments. In fact, one of the modules centers around a particular tournament in a neighboring city. You know, the power and influence of the PCs is beyond just what cool gear do I have and kind of what monster is in the next room. You know, it actually takes on a more of a, yeah, like you said, geopolitical presence, Jeff. So it's really, really interesting. It's a huge territory. As the series goes on, the sphere of influence that the wilderness is keeps going and going. I forget exactly what level it caps out at. And there is an overarching plot to each individual module, and they're loosely tied. They're not there is a common thread throughout the whole thing as well. Really, the hardest part about this whole thing is it requires an experienced GM to really run this effectively. Because, you know, your time span that you're talking about, that's one cool thing about it too, is the time span. So, you know, whereas like in a particular adventure path or, you know, series of adventures, you know, you start at first level and, you know, we're all fresh off the farm 20-year-olds, and, you know, you go over through a year to 2 year timeline, and all of a sudden you're these 10th level guys who can face anything, and only, you know, I'm now, instead of being 20 years fresh off the farm, I'm 22 years old, but I'm the master of the universe, you know? Well, this thing, because the turns are months or, you know, seasons or things like that, you know, it makes a natural progression for your characters. So it makes sense that I'm 35 at 8th level rather than being 21 and 8th level, things like that. But like,
right,
I said, it requires an experienced GM.
I don't know.
There's
why.
Not a...
I was about to say, you know what that reminds me of? Was it Pendragon?
Yes.
Pendragon.
Yes, Pendragon.
That,
you could...
That was kind of like that, where it's like you kind of... It's like really the characters are more like your family line.
Yep. No, you're right. That's exactly what it was.
So.
Yeah. But there's not a lot of structure. It needs an experienced GM. And really, honestly, the kingdom building mechanic is not well play tested.
Okay.
In fact, if I were to run this, what I would do is I would love to run this adventure, but I would look at one of two possibilities. First of all, like exactly like Jeff mentioned, I would look at the rules inside first edition AD&D about henchmen and kingdoms and castles and things like that. Or there is another system called Adventurer Conqueror King, which is it's an old school Renaissance system that came out, but it is built primarily exactly like what you were talking about, Jeff, where characters are not meant to basically just be monster slayers throughout their entire career. Instead, as they grow, their influence grows, and then they begin to take on, you know, kingdoms, or, well, you know, baronies, and then whatever, all the way up to full-fledged kingdoms, and then leaders of armies and whatnot. It's called ACKS or AKCS or something like that is the abbreviation for it. I think you can get it for like $10 off of RPG Now. But I would look at one of those two and probably borrow one of the kingdom building things from those systems rather than just using the one in the adventure straight up. So to finish it off, this adventure path I don't believe it's any longer in print, but Paizo has lots of copies in their warehouse. You can get it for $14 in PDF form for each of the 6 booklets. So it's like 14 times 6. They're $20 in print.
Wow. You almost buy, if you can get them in print, you might as well get them in print almost.
Well, and so, in fact, Amazon has them for about $15 in print, though they don't have all of them currently. They occasionally get them. So I've got most of mine through Amazon. I did get one of them through Paizo. But it's a great system that really encourages this open gaming kind of play, open gaming style of play that you were talking about, Ben. It allows lots of different character types and consequently player types to cooperate in the goals of managing this kingdom, and you know, whether you want to be a war king, you know, war based kingdom, or you want to be diplomacy or whatever it is. There's, I don't know, it's just, it's a really great system. I haven't played it to conclusion, but what I have played has been a lot of fun, with a lot of opportunities to really just flex your role playing chops, so to say.
Yeah, really interesting. I've never, honestly, that I've heard of it. I just never really knew much about it. So, all right. Well, last up, of course, is well, let's face it. What's one of the I don't know if I want to call it an influence or not an influence. MMOs. You know, it's like, honestly, you know, RPGs have, pencil and paper RPGs, of course, have, you know, we've been doing various computerized versions of those for years. I mean, I don't think any of us would dismiss that fact, right?
Right.
Yeah. No, definitely not.
You know, but it's interesting. I was actually, this came up because, I don't know, I think it was on the old school gaming group on Facebook. Someone posted something, and they were talking about MMOs and their obvious relationship with, you know, the influence of them on gaming. And I was thinking, you know, that's actually kind of an interesting topic. And, you know, obviously, you know, because, you know, there are many things that I think have come out of that. You know, it's like, and he points a few of them out that I think are interesting. I don't know if he's 100% correct in everything he says, obviously, but I just thought they were interesting because he was talking about things like, you know, how, you know, he thought that new players, you know, a lot of their watchwords are, you know, they didn't like character morality as much. They didn't like, you know, there's this whole thing about play balance that, and I think we've talked about this before in many, in some of our podcasts.
That is so hard to achieve.
Well, first off, it is so hard to achieve, but it's also, it's kind of an interesting thing because if you look at, you know, I always tell people, when you look at first edition AD&D, there was like, well, a fifth level fighter doesn't equal a fifth level magic user.
I see. Right.
And my answer to that is, you're right. But if you look at the experience points, that's the way, you know, the idea was is that at a certain point, the party wouldn't be the same level.
You right.
know, the fighters would have, progressed faster than the magic users, and that was on purpose. No, I'm serious.
You need a tank.
Well, no. I mean, and that was on purpose. And when you break it down, you're like, you know, it's kind of weird because then on the other hand, what the flip side of that, of course, was is that you know when you move to one experience points table for all the people, it was just kind of like, well, then you did have an issue because yeah, a fifth level fighter never equals a fifth level magic user, no matter what you do. And conversely, though, the other issue is, of course, is that now you have, well, how do you balance that? And, you know, really should, you know, if you don't have the same experience point chart, then it gets really complex for people to remember everything. And it's just like, okay. And, so, you know, it's like you trade certain issues for other issues. But, you know, I thought that was kind of interesting. He brought up play balance. What was the other one? He mentioned... yeah, that they expect to, well, what the hell? I don't think they expect to, I don't know, it's my software that I have to, that had the notes, I highlighted something and it moved something around. You know, it was a, you know, that they have, you know, some people expect, you know, like, A, if their characters die, there's going to be some sort of easy resurrection, or, you know, that they're going to be able to defeat any monster they might be able to encounter, because after all, we would never encounter a monster that we can't defeat.
I hate that.
And
hence the reason we've had so many TPKs.
Right, but you know, I mean, it is interesting is that, you know,
sometimes you have to run away.
You know, but I mean, is that, I mean, I think that's more of a, I mean, I do, I mean, I hate to sound like a grognard, but it is, I think that is more of a more modern issue for us because we've kind of come to the step that, well, it's not fun if the players can't defeat the monster. I don't know. That just seems like the mindset that we've gotten to a certain
degree. Well, it is, but for an MMO, you know, MMOs have to cater to a much broader range of player than a pen and paper game, right?
But the argument is the problem is that, you know, is that for, you know, MMOs have brought people into the pencil and paper hobby.
To some extent.
You know, I think that's less than what people like to think. But there is an argument that, and so because of that, the perceptions that the MMO characters and gaming in general, you know, various video games in general, have brought back to RPGs, because, you know, obviously RPGs have given so much to video games in varying aspects. I mean, honestly, let's face it. Of course,
like probably, the whole category of RPGs as a computer game.
Yeah, I don't ever buy that. I always hate when games list, we're an RPG. Really? No. I don't think there's any role playing. There's role assumption, but I'm dishing out semantics at this point. But you know, it's interesting because, you know, there is this argument that obviously that, you know, MMOs have supposedly brought people into gaming, you know, tabletop gaming. And I'm not saying there haven't been some people. It's just like the argument that people say, well, collectible card games saved RPGs. Yes and no. I mean, most people I know that do collectible card games, they don't have any interest in RPGs at all. The only thing that it did was the companies that obviously produced RPGs were able to continue existence. That's about the only way it saved RPGs. But if you want to say that those people transcended that to tabletop RPGs, I've never seen that really that much. I don't know too many, and this is just me, I don't know too many RPGers that I have at my table that have ever played Magic the Gathering, for example.
Actually, I see it quite a bit.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just me. I'm just saying.
It's funny. I actually have seen that quite a bit, in large part, mostly in a game store setting. Now, at my personal table, you're right. I don't. But when I'm at the game store, a lot of times what will happen is, you know, especially like, say, Friday Night Magic, for instance, there will be a bunch of kids playing, and, hey, we'll have one of the tables playing D&D, and pretty soon a couple of kids wonder, hey, what are you guys doing? You know, and we come over, hey, we're playing D&D. And so there definitely has been a lot of cross-pollinization. In fact, at the store where I play, not regularly, but when I get a chance, I play over there. Right now, there's a game of 13th Age going on that it was started by one of these kids who played collectible card games and board games, and kind of was introduced to the hobby via the game store where we all played. And, you know, so there definitely is some cross-pollinization there, if for no other reason that the place where you purchase and play them is usually the same locale.
Okay. Now, you know, and I'm not, okay, that, I mean, and so, like I said, I'm not saying that there isn't any. It's just like, for example, with the people I play with, I would say there's none. And I mean, that might just be my group.
So. Well, unless you play in a place where cross-pollinization like that can take place, you're right. It's highly doubtful that a Magic the Gathering player is going to knock on your door, Jeff, and say, hey, I heard you guys play RPGs. I'd like to join.
Well, I mean, that actually brings up a whole different topic, which is, you know, in this day and age, even with the electronic capabilities we have to send an email around the world, it's incredibly hard to get a group together.
Yeah, actually, well, Ben, it sounds like your group is one of those that plays. Well, yeah. You guys play via virtual tabletop, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Which one?
We use the sharing capability of Dungeonographer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So basically, you have to speak what you want to do, and then somebody moves the map for you. You know, it's not a true, but it is really, really easy to use, and this doesn't require a lot of.
Dungeonographer, yeah, we've had that good guy.
Yeah, Inkwell.
Yeah, Inkwell Ideas. I love their Hexographer myself.
Yeah, that's good too.
Yeah, you know, Hexographer. You know, it's like, honestly, mapping and dungeon mapping at its easiest. I'm sorry.
You know, for our open world, it's very effective.
But you know, we're digressing. But you know, it's interesting that I love the concept of. Campaign Cartographer, I got news for you. It's useless to me.
Yeah.
It really is. It's like, for me, it's killing a flea with an elephant gun.
Yeah.
It's like, I actually would get better results with you know, using, you know, very, you know, Microsoft Paint, for Christ's sake. You know, I'm serious. It really is that bad, because it's like, you know, I just want something that I want to sketch on. I want to sketch out my maps. It's like, that's the way I know how to do it. You know, and it's the funny thing is that even with wanting to sketch it, it's actually easier for me to sketch it on paper and scan it than it is for me to really, because I even had, like, I bought, like, a small little one of those stylus things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is it? Wacom.
Like architects use.
No, not necessarily Wacom. More artists. It's like the really low end commercial versions of them.
Yeah, the Wacom. Right?
Wacom. Yeah, I have a.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I have a really tiny Bamboo, and even that I couldn't really get into using. It was just like, you know, it's interesting, but there's just something with the feel of the paper. I just could never get into using that. So, you know, it's sad because it's like I want to, but I can't. It's just not in me. So
yeah.
I'm running up the limitations of my own, you know, my own generational skills, I guess. I don't know. My own set in my ways problems. But still, again, getting back to the MMOs, I mean, the question has always been is like, you know, has this create, you know, has the influence back from MMOs created unreal expectations and, you know, what, you know, in role playing games, I don't know. I mean, it's always, you know, because there was always that thing, you know, where people said, oh, you know, fourth edition was basically a video game. In a way,
I never played fourth edition.
You know, I never did either. I kind of took a look at it and said, this is just not the game for me.
Well, yeah. It's funny you mention that because really, I mean, that is one of the biggest complaints about fourth edition is that it modeled a, you know, MMO almost, you know, or video game to the T. In fact, even so much, you know, Ben, you mentioned tanks where they have, you know, right. In D&D or D&D 4th edition, they had so many classes that they actually elevated a new definition. They called them roles, which they had defenders, which of course were tanks. Then they had, what else did they have? They had leaders, strikers.
Oh, gee.
And controllers.
What the fuck was a striker? I didn't understand.
So those were all different types of fighters?
No, they were different roles that you could have classes. So in other words, whereas in, you know, D&D, primitive D&D, or like in Pathfinder even, you know, like you have your rogue, your fighter, your...
magic user.
Yeah, magic user, wizard.
I'm sorry, I still use that term.
Or cleric. You know, because they had so many classes, just like an MMO does, you know, that they couldn't call them all fighters, so they just said, well, now they're defenders. So, you know, you had a fighter, which was a defender, a paladin, which was a defender, a hunter was a defender, a ranger was a defender. Actually, I think a ranger was a striker, a rogue was a striker, an assassin wasn't a striker. You know, I mean, just anyways, long story short, it's the funny thing about 4th edition, really, as far as MMO goes, I think that was their primary goal, was to make something that was accessible from people playing video games and MMOs. And I think to a large extent they achieved their purpose. However, really what it boiled down to was that it wasn't fun around the table. It took too long, too many choices. So.
Yeah, I mean, and the this guy goes on with one additional interesting point that I think is where was it here? Let me. Okay, and this is I don't think it's weird. He lists this as an MMO. Influence, and I'm not sure it's an MMO influence. I think it's just kind of the way we progressed with skills in gaming, you know, like character skills.
Right.
Which was just wanting to roll the dice to resolve a situation instead of role-playing. And, you know, it's funny. I've seen this. If you look at even like D&D 3.5 or... Hell, I'm going to use a Spycraft example. I remember playing a Spycraft game with somebody. Now, a lot of this, I think, was problems with the game master.
Uh-huh.
You know, but I remember, you know, my character picked up a phone, and somebody asked if somebody was there, and I just said, no, they're not here. You know? And he wanted me so like, well, you need to roll your bluff skill. And I'm thinking, really? Why do I need to bluff this person when all I said is just they're not here? That's not like I'm trying to convince them that, you know, China is not communist or something.
Well, but right. if you rolled a critical fumble, it would have gone something like, "Hey George, are you here?"
Well,
no, George isn't here.
Well, I understand that, but I mean, it's like Well, you know, I as a person, I take into the situation. It's like if you call somebody and someone says they're not there, you don't question whether or not someone's really not there 99.9% of the time.
Right.
You know, and I don't know why you would have, you know, it's like that would almost be an unconscious skill. It's like it would almost be like for me, it would be more like if I was a game master and I wanted to use a mechanic for that, I wouldn't have the player rolling a bluff skill. I would have whoever the NPC is rolling some sort of check against some sort of static number to realize that I was lying.
Right. And then it'd be up to you whether or not to reveal that to the player.
Right, exactly. Because it would make no sense for me to roll my bluff skill. So sometimes that's just an experienced DMD. But again, it's like, yeah, that's more of a role-playing thing. It's like, you know, you only use the dice when all of a sudden the role-playing, you're like, well, is there any reason, you know, has, you know, plus or minus, you know, like if it's been good role-playing, you give a bonus to a die roll. If it's been bad role-playing, you might give a penalty, you know.
Right.
You know, I always, honestly, the infamous example for always a failed bluff skill was always, you know, Han Solo in, you know, the original Star Wars movie. You know.
With Greedo?
Where he shoots Greedo?
No. When they're down in the detention block.
Oh, everything's fine here.
Yeah, exactly.
How are you?
Exactly. I mean, that's like the classic failed bluff, if there is one. You know.
I agree.
So, it's like, because I can imagine, you know, it's like, that would be the one that thinks like, well, what do you tell them?
Yeah.
And if that's what he came out with, obviously you're just like, you know what, no one's going to believe you, you know. And I don't want to mean, it's weird because, I mean, and I think that's the problem that skills have sometimes brought to gaming, you know, when your characters have certain skills, you know, because originally most RPGs, characters had no skills. You were either able to do something or you weren't, pretty much. But yeah, I always think that that's an interesting thing is because it's like, when you have skills, you're like, well, my character knows it, but I don't. Okay, you know, I can understand that. I mean, because that's kind of what happens anyway. I mean, we can't be our characters. Otherwise, it wouldn't be role-playing. It would be, hey, this is real life. I'm just going to use my real-world knowledge to, you know,
Let's play Papers and Paychecks.
Exactly. Papers and Paychecks. Exactly, you know. And apparently my paycheck is just not enough. So, you know, I mean, that's one of those things. But, yeah, I think that's the thing. You know, skills have come into play. And I don't think this is necessarily, again, I don't think this is, from my point of view, when I look at that, it's like, yes, I do agree that that is a problem. But I don't know if that's an MMO straight problem or if that's a problem we've always had. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just interesting because I do think that we have had some MMO influences on gaming and I'm not sure if it's all good. I mean, if it's all bad, you know, some of it, you know, obviously, like you said, we do have some new blood and gaming changes. I mean, it's just, you know, as we pointed out at the early part of the episode that you weren't in on was obviously D&D has been around for 40 years. So role-playing games as a pencil and paper option, if you look at it from a time frame that's anything outside of, like, you know, 5 years.
Yeah.
It's not that long. I mean, you know, if you look at it from the sense that, you know, it hasn't even been around a century. You know?
Right.
I mean, Monopoly's been around longer, for Pete's sake. And, ironically.
And it's evolved.
But not that much.
No, not that much.
You know, I mean, but that's the thing. Most games will evolve.
You can get a My Little Pony Monopoly. That's awesome.
Are you a secret brony?
No.
Okay.
But I am parent to several. Well, I guess they're not bronies because they're girls. But
yeah, my daughter had that phase for a couple of years.
Yeah. No, it's like I actually. Speaking of bronies, I actually ran into one in the middle of the oddest place. I was actually at a rifle training event, and this guy was like talking that he was like a brony, and I'm just like, I think you want to stop mentioning that around. Yeah, we don't really want to hear about that right now. You know, I think you're in the wrong group of people to be mentioning that you're a brony.
So what was his pony name?
I have no idea.
I'm Sparkling Bullet.
Something like that. I don't know. So anyway, you know, I just thought it was interesting, you know, that, I mean, because I don't know. I mean, do you think there's been too much influence for gaming, or do we overblow this in general?
No, I think it's been huge.
It's funny. D&D 4th edition, I think, was a grand experiment that I think most people would say flopped. There were some redeeming factors of it, but for the most part, D&D 4th edition pretty much just sales-wise didn't do anything. I think what's really been interesting, though, is that as people play MMOs, of course, they run into the difficulties of, being able to fully stretch what they want to do. And that's where they, you know, they've turned to tabletop games, and several of these more rules light but organic systems have filled that niche where they look at it, they can pick it up. I mean, you know, Pathfinder and Dungeons and Dragons, at least, you know, 4th edition, you look at them in their current incarnations. And if I were to say, you know, hey, let's sit down and play this game after you've been playing, you know, World of Warcraft, which takes almost nothing to get into, you know, you'd look at it and say, God, I have to read a 600-page book. Whereas, you know, some of these other systems, you know, like, heck, I mean, actually playing a game of Fiasco is a great way to introduce people to role-playing. You know, and that's like a 50-page book in a couple hours, you know, and you're like, that's role-playing. And they're like, wow, that's amazing, you know. I can't do that in World of Warcraft, or I can't do that in EVE Online, or, you know, something like that.
Right, because, well, you know, it goes back to what I've always said about, as a programmer, I always love when people say, well, we want to force people to do XYZ. And my answer to 90% of that problem is, then write your procedures that way. Well, we want to prevent the users from doing that. Well, guess what? Procedures are easy to change. Writing the program to change to force them to do certain things is not. And what I've seen happen many times is that if you're a programmer, you'll write something that forces users to go through a certain set of steps, and then 10 years later, they're like, these steps are so irrelevant to how we do business today.
Isn't that called job security?
No, that's just called writing bad programming because someone forced you to do something. You know, a system should never... I mean, but I'm just saying, it's like that's, you know, and I've seen that happen, you know.
So, of course.
I mean, but I think that's what happens in MMOs is that, you know, there's a certain structure and they hit the limit of the structure. And when you go to pencil and paper role playing, that's what the game master's for. The game master is to adjudicate things. I'm going to say that word again, adjudicate.
Where the MMOs do a really good job is keeping the complexity to the end user at a bare minimum.
Right.
And they can get very into the nuance of a particular set of whatever, you know, armor, weapon, whatever. But they can basically ignore the mechanics of how all of that stuff works.
You're right, because the mechanics are hidden, whereas RPGs tend to expose a little bit more of the mechanics.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, because it's like, now you can, if as a game master, if you want to take on the role of the operating system, if you will...
Right.
And don't get me wrong, I've done that. I mean, I've played...
it depends on your
play RuneQuest.
Well, I was thinking of Twilight 2000, the original...
Oh, that too. Yeah.
Original Twilight 2000. You know, as the game master...
Any game that has a hit chart, really.
Well, the original Twilight 2000 was really complicated, because then it's like, okay, well, you have this armor, and then this weapon has this penetration multiplier, and then you roll your dice, and it's like, you know, and then there's all these calculations. It was much easier as a game master for me to do all those calculations than to force the players to do them.
Sure.
You know, because I understood what was going on. So, you know, depending on your game master, a good game master can hide some of those complexities if necessary. But again, I mean, that throws a lot of weight on the game master rather than the players themselves.
So I would say it's a different influence. I would say that maybe the MMOs have contributed to the blooming of all these rules light systems. Maybe that's the appeal of the rules light. Is that
I think that's the reaction to it. Yeah.
Yeah. That might be a reaction. One reaction. I think the other reaction, of course, is just that as older gamers, we just don't have time to deal with something really complex.
Oh, I can't remember any of that stuff.
Yeah. No, I mean, honestly, I'm not going to lie. As an older gamer, I look at some systems and like, I have no time to learn the rules. And I mean, that might have been why at a certain level I'm just like when I look at D&D 4th edition, I'm just like, this isn't the game for me. I don't want to learn a whole new set of rules just to play a game that I already own.
Right.
And I mean, that goes a long way with a lot of things. It's like, you know, that's obviously, if you've listened to the show, and most of our listeners hopefully have, you know, that's been my reaction to Mongoose Traveler. It's like,
yeah,
why buy a game that I already own in a way?
Yeah.
You know, they're like, well, you know, it made some improvements, but it's still basically the same game. And I'm like, well, okay, you just lost me there.
Well, I already own that one.
You know, okay. You know, you're not winning this fight. It's like, and then, of course, Mongoose being produced, all the materials produced, I think, in England, with all the weird, that's why their books are so expensive here.
That.
You know, and I'm not arguing that. I mean, it's the same thing with Cubicle 7. That's the same problem they have with Doctor Who. I mean, their material is fantastic. It looks great, but it's expensive because of the way the whole transportation, VAT tax, and all that other weird crap comes into play. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, I'm not faulting them. It's just that's the reality of me being in America and them being in Europe.
Right.
And it's like, you know, I'm not arguing that they don't produce good material. I'm just saying that for me, I have to look at what I want to spend my money on. And for what I perceive value as right now, their cost is too high. So,
yeah.
But that diverts. All right. Well, anything else on the subject before we close out the show?
No, I think we said it all.
All right. I doubt that, but you know, I always feign ignorance on actually being able to say it all, unless it was such a tiny topic that there was only two options. So, at any rate, you know. Obviously,
blue pill, red pill.
Yeah, exactly. So, obviously, you know, if you have anything you want to say to us, you can, of course, contact us through the variety of ways that we have, which includes email at info@rpgcircus.com. You can go to our Facebook page. Just look for RPG Circus in Facebook, or we have a Google Plus page. If you go to Google Plus, look for RPG Circus. We're there. You can go to our homepage, rpgcircus.com, and you can send us a voicemail via the SpeakPipe app that's attached there. And of course, you know, hey, you know, while you're at our homepage, you can always request stickers from us, which I still have some. I'm thinking about changing, you know, the banner and the logo at some point. So, you know, I'm not going to say they're going to be collector's items, but I might do that. Because, I mean, we've been kind of with the current theme for, I don't know, the last couple of years, 3 years, something like that.
Oh, yeah, at least.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's almost time for a change. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just, you know, it's time.
Something fresh.
Exactly. And, you know, if you want to, you can be like Ben and a couple others that we have queued up. You can come on the show and guest host with us, bring a topic and talk with us and have a fun time. Pretty basic requirements. Pretty much at this point, you have to be able to use Skype in some way. And we typically record on Tuesdays around 9:30 Eastern Standard Time. So, if that's a possibility for you and you'd like to come on, you know, shoot us an email and we'll see what we can do. Like I said, we already got, I think we got one or two people I definitely know we have lined up for the next couple of shows, hopefully, which is cool, you know, because honestly, this show is nothing without people coming in and bringing fresh ideas, because I know I get a little stale. I don't know about you, Jay. You get stale?
I'm brittle.
You're brittle. I see. Okay. You're a piece of ice. I understand. So, but of course, with that, you know.
I'm so stale, I'm a crouton.
Well, I'd like to thank Ben for working through all the technical issues and things that have happened and, you know, obviously coming on the show and sharing us our topic because, you know, this is what makes the show great. I mean, is that we have several people with differing opinions. Sometimes the same opinion, but different ideas and different concepts, because that's what makes gaming great. You know what? I don't have to agree with your gaming choices, but, you know, we're all gamers at the end of the day.
I just won't play with you.
I'm going to take my dice and go home. Exactly. So with that, I'm going to say adieu for this episode, and hope everyone's enjoyed it.
I did.
All right. And we'll see you guys in 2 weeks. RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons U.S. license 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.